I just noticed in an article that Zara was telling me that she wrote under her maiden name, which is an article about what May Day means to women. She wrote the Sunday Work Home in 1940 before the war.
Mm-hmm.
And she said that she used her maiden name.
I used my maiden name all through the 30s. When I entered the Local 6, the official felt that since I was very well known as a communist and as a leader in women's work of the left, that perhaps I ought to work in the union under my married name. And so I changed it, and from that time on, I was known as Zara Spooner. Although the federal government had issued an end-day plan, which indicated that the operation of some of the regulations and restrictions relating to women's work would be suspended, perhaps, in our industry, the workers were so low paid that we could continue to press for better working conditions, even though such restrictions may have been applied in other industries.
So your union, even during the war, pressed for better conditions?
During the war, we pressed for better conditions because for the first time in the history of the hotel, they were doing an enormous business. Their rooms were constantly filled because there was so much movement in the country. There was never any problem in them not being able to afford better conditions for the workers, and we pushed very hard for these. It was not easy, I must say, that the officials worked very hard. But some gains were made practically every year.
Now, did your union prepare at all for what was going to happen after the war?
Towards the end of the war, we had to consider the problems of returning workers, returning from the store. But as far as the hotels were concerned, there was no problems of conversion, there were no problems of large-scale unemployment, because the hotels were always, during this period and after the war, very prosperous.
Mm-hmm.
After the war also, because mm-hmm. there was tremendous movement in the country, and the hotels had not expanded. There was very little building of new hotels, but the population was expanding all the time, and people were coming home and needing homes, and they would go into hotels temporarily. There was a period of real prosperity all through the 40s in the hotel. Now,
and you got a living wage at this time.
Oh, yes. The workers were quite pleased with the results, with their belonging to the union. They supported the union.
And
we were able to get, after the war, union contracts were confined largely to fringe benefits, that is to say, sickness, health insurance, and things of that sort that the employers gave, because the officers felt that they couldn't perhaps push for further increases. But this was a cause of great friction in the union. There were those who felt that we should push all the way for better and better wage conditions and hours and so on, and other improvements in the economic status of the workers. Whereas the officials who had to deal with the top hotel owners, many of whom were in corporate industry, were convinced that they couldn't get anything and that the best that they could do for the workers would be to get the fringe benefits, which they felt were very important. They established a health center after the war was over. Workers could come and get examinations, medical examinations. Sickness pay. There were a number of other fringe benefits which were established, but which did not meet fully with the acceptance of the of the left-wing organizers who felt that the top officials were not pressing hard enough for
the top officials were not the left.
The top officials were all of the left, but were moving away towards a sort of respectable status. In mm-hmm. other words, they were no longer officially connected in any way, you see.
And what did you do about them moving away? Did you see that they were moving away and try to change it, or were you happy that they were getting into the establishment?
No, I think most of us felt that the top officials should be, in a sense, protected from the reactionary elements within the AFL. And that if they were too openly associated with the Communist Party or with any of the left-wing organizations, that they might have problems in running the union. But nevertheless, there was a close association by the union officials and the top officials also in many of those of the United Front organizations around the left. And that is how I became involved in the Joint Anti-Fascist Refugee Committee. Our union had been a contributor to the Anti-Fascist Refugee Committee because of our concern about the Spanish refugees from the Spanish Civil War. And when the Joint Anti-Fascist Refugee Committee was organized in the early 40s, Michael Obermeyer was the official representative sponsored by our executive board to the committee. Obermeyer didn't attend many of their meetings. He knew very little about the organization, but they gave the authorization of the Hotel and Club Employees Union as sponsor of the Joint Anti-Fascist Refugee Committee. Along about 1946, after the war was over, Obermeyer approached me and asked me if I would be willing to take his place on the Joint Anti-Fascist Refugee Committee as a representative of Local 6. And he told me about his past experience, that he had never been very active on the committee. But now he had many new responsibilities in the union. And he himself was already involved with the FBI. The FBI had been checking up on all the officials of all local unions, and they found that he was deportable because he had never been able to achieve citizenship. And he was in great trouble, and he was quite worried. So he asked me whether I would do it, and I said if I got the authority of the executive board, I would do it, but not unless I got such authority. I was quite reluctant to join that committee because I had enough to do and I had many responsibilities at home. And actually, I did it only because I felt that if I didn't do it, then the Joint Anti-Fascist Refugee Committee might be deprived of a representative of the union.
Couldn't you have had a rank and file member? Or?
Well, I think the committee wanted an official.
Mm-hmm.
And none of the organizers were willing to do it because they were all very, very deeply involved in union work and working very hard in many very late hours. Often
so were you.
So was I. Mm-hmm. But when Obermeyer approached me this way, I felt that I had the duty to do this. And that is how I became a member of the Joint Anti-Fascist Refugee Committee. It was brought before the executive board, and the executive board approved my serving as a representative of Local 6. And it was understood that all expenses or anything involved in my association with the committee would be met by the union.
Now, you became active in it, not like Obermeyer. You assumed a lot of responsibility.
No,
right?
I really didn't. I don't think I attended more than two or three meetings before the House Un-American Activities Committee began its investigation of the Joint Anti-Fascist Refugee Committee. The committee itself had very wide support all over the country. It was one of the biggest United Fronts that had ever been established. The feeling for the Spanish Civil War was very strong in the country, even among those who were not really fully associated with the left. And it was possible to get a great many supporters in the committee that would normally not be associated with the left at all. And this is evident in our board. There were quite a number of people on the board who were people who had not been really in any way associated with the left. For example, Shumlin, who was one of the theater directors, and other people of this nature who were attracted to the committee because of the fact that we were working for the Spanish refugees.
So you were not really, you just went to two meetings.
I went to two, I think, altogether two meetings in 46, and in 47 the investigation began. Now, before we go into that, I want to say a few final words about my association.
Okay.
Yes.
In looking for a job before you got the local six job,
yes,
you applied for many jobs.
Yes, and found that although many of the people were friendly to the progressive movement, they were not willing to accept me because I was too well identified as a left winger.
You applied to the Consumers Union?
I applied to the Consumers Union for a job on their publication, and they were very interested, but they kept my name for future reference, and I never heard from them. I also was interviewed by the manager of the Modern Age Books, and gave them a resume of myself and the kind of book I would like to write and ask for an advance. And this also was not
the kind of book was a labor history, letting labor speak for itself.
Right. It was an attempt to bring together to integrate into a coherent pattern the writings and speeches of leaders of labor, convention decisions and resolutions, press editorials and articles, and letters from the rank and file, so that it would provide a broad survey of the labor movement at the time, its thinking and aspirations, its achievement and its influence as a powerful social force. Considered a good idea, it was not the manager indicated that it might not be commercially feasible.
Charlotte just found this article in going through her papers. It really belongs in the early 30s tape, so it should be inserted somehow in that tape.
As an editor of the Labor Defender, I was asked by our Yonker group to come there to speak in the public park, because there had been a ban on public speeches, and they wanted to test the First Amendment and the right for the use of the public park for making speeches. I went with a group of young people to the park on August 1st, 1930. What does that say? I can't read it.
Those arrested were held in $500 bail, each on charges of disorderly conduct.
Yes. The group of us went to the park. We set up a box, and each one made a speech.
Like the RWW speech movement.
Yes. They made a speech in regard to the right of people to use the park, the public park, paid for by the taxes of the people of the city of Yonkers, to speak their minds on any subject. After the first speech, the second person who started to speak was immediately arrested because the police by this time had learned about this, and we had quite a gathering of people who were passing through the park. And as each person got up to speak and opened his mouth and said, friends, he was taken down from the stand and said he was under, and it was said that he was under arrest. I was the last speaker, and by the time I got up, the police had become quite brutal. They were using their sticks to stop us from speaking. There had been actually four speakers before me. I was the fifth speaker. And when I got up, they stopped me almost immediately, and we were all taken to the court and held overnight in jail to come up before the... No, I'm not sure about that. I think we were probably held until the night court, held that day. In the meantime, local group had contacted the labor defense attorney, and we were brought up before the night court, and we testified. We were charged with disorderly conduct, and we testified about our right to speak in a public park and our reasons for doing this. And the court withheld, we were released, I believe, on bail.
Yes, $500 bail.
On $500 bail. By the international, supplied by the International Labor Defense, and the court was to make a judgment in regard to the action that we had taken. I never found out about the decision, except that I learned from the attorneys that the matter had been tabled. When Mira was old enough to do some research, she was, I think, then in high school, which must have been in the 40s. She went to the Yonkers courthouse and found the records and copied them. And this is what the records said. Communist case set for August 14th. Quote, all charges of disorderly conduct, a misdemeanor punishable by 1 year imprisonment, are a fine of $500 or both. The TOTUS woman is charged by Patrolman Alexander Young with having attempted to continue the meeting. Miss Charlotte TOTUS, who said she was a graduate of a Boston high school and Radcliffe College, Cambridge, Mass., testified that when she was brought to the station, she was fingerprinted over her She said she told the officer that it was unlawful to fingerprint any prisoner before conviction and told them that she wanted to see her attorney. She declared that Lieutenant George Ford said to her, I will tell you all the law you need. She also protested, she said, against the way one of the officers was holding her hand while she was being fingerprinted. Continuing, Miss Totis said that one of the officers hit Barrett over the head with a nightstick. Presumably this was one of the people arrested. She said that Barrett looked as if he was about to faint, and when she asked to be allowed to get him a glass of water, she was told this place is not a hospital. There's more here. She also noted that on August 2nd, when the three women and four men were arraigned today before Acting City Judge Gerald Nolan in the city court, their bail was continued and the case put off until August 8th. They are represented by the law firm of Klein & Klein. The defendant told Mr. Klein that she was employed by the International Labor Defense, an organization to defend the people in free speech and labor fights. The city court.
I think that shows the variety of activities that you were engaged in. And right. You hardly remember going through all these papers.
Yes. After the war, My activities in the union were primarily concerned with education, and I arranged various types of lectures, classes. We used to have an induction ceremony every time new members came into the union, and they were very frequent because it was enormous turnover. We would have an induction ceremony, and then the president of the union would give them an oath of membership, and I would lecture to them about their responsibilities as union members. At this time also, we were involved in many discussions in regard to party life in the party groups in which I participated.
The party group in which you participated, which was what?
Which was the union.
Oh, it's the union party.
The union caucus, or the union fraction of party members. And this is a period when Browder was was expelled, and there was a tremendous amount of discussion among the members. And we had recruited several people during those years who made up our group, so that we had quite a large representation from the hotel workers. I attended these caucus meetings, but I must admit that I didn't participate very fully. I was quite confused about the Browder situation, and I accepted on faith the discussions that went on in regard to revisionism and the necessity for putting the party on the right track, and perhaps it was largely that I had a heavy schedule in the union. I can't exactly account for the fact that I was largely silent during these discussions.
Well, did you discuss these issues with Bernard?
Did you?
Bernard?
Yes. We had a number of discussions on these issues, and he was no longer connected in any way with the... he was still an editor of Science and Society, and still his convictions hadn't changed, but he was no longer involved in party politics particularly, and he never was involved in party politics actually, but he was less interested because he was now very much in a much better situation than he had been for many years. He was more acceptable to the Columbia faculty. He was now given full-time work. He was during this period he had several visiting professorships, and he taught at Yale. He was very well known for his medical books by this time, and was considered the father of medical sociology. In other words, he had introduced a new discipline in the sociological field, medical sociology. So that he also was very much involved in his scholarly work and his activities in the university, and he couldn't give a great deal of attention to it, but he kept informed, and I'm not sure how he felt about the changes that were taking place in the party, because I don't recall any particular differences of opinion or anything of that sort that occurred at that time. Besides, we had a growing daughter. We had lots of problems in connection with her. She was getting in high school. We were concerned about her future. There were many things that distracted us. And I must say that I was less active in communist activities than I had ever been before. I continued teaching as the catalogs show in Workers' School and also in...
Workers' School in Harlem.
In the Workers' School in the city, and also in the Workers' School in the Carver School, as it was called, which was a Workers' School in Harlem. And I participated in a great many of the women's activities. I continued my participation there.
Do you think you were getting discouraged from the party?
No, I wasn't. I wasn't. I was just tired, and I wasn't... I never was terribly involved in the political discussions. I was a convinced I had the conviction, but I somehow or other didn't know how to cope with political arguments. At least I wasn't very effective.
Do you think it was male chauvinism that they
no.
didn't encourage people?
No, because they very often came and discussed problems with me, uh-huh. the party problems
did
with me.
Each side try
and
to
there was
on
there
that
was a,
side?
No, there was a great deal of explanation and discussion, but I somehow or other didn't show very great interest in what was taking place. I was silent.
Mm-hmm.
My recollection is that I used to sit in awe as so many of the younger members who had been recruited by me would get up in party meetings and make statements about politics and the world problems and were listened to, and I just didn't feel that I could make much of a contribution, I guess. I can't explain.
Well, Elizabeth Shirley Flynn in her diary says the same thing.
That's
true.
Yeah.
You
think it may have to do with women?
I don't
there
know.
Were
many
women,
I don't know. I just don't know. I don't know what it has to do with.
Yeah.
It has to do with.
There was something about political discussions in the party that made me feel inadequate to that situation. Now,
well, maybe you just didn't connect with the real world and you couldn't relate to it.
That's possible. I can't give you an adequate explanation. I have very warm convictions and enthusiasms, and I would undertake any responsibility that was assigned to me. But when it came to these more difficult problems of whether Browder was a revisionist and whether he had done the right thing or the wrong thing and whether the position that the others took was better and different, and I wasn't able to make these distinctions very well.
Had you been enthusiastic about Browderism?
No, I never was. I was never an enthusiast about any of the party officials. I knew Browder well, and mm-hmm. Several times Browder called me into his office to discuss things with him. And, of course, I had great admiration for Foster. I thought he was one of the greatest, you know. I really revered him as a working-class leader.
How about Dennis?
I didn't know Dennis very
mm-hmm.
well. And my recollections of Dennis were not terribly good. He was in Seattle when I was there. And he's at that time, he was rather an aggressive, authoritative youngster.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't like what he represented, but he changed. He was different later. However, I never got to know him at all. And the discussions, somehow or other, I was not able to cope with them.
You had weekly meetings?
We had weekly meetings, yes. We met a great deal during that period. And then there were district conferences.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were national conferences to which I was always invited because I was a member of the National Women's Commission, you see.
Right.
I was invited to all these things. I attended all these affairs. But
you
I was not a great participant. The only participation I had was in the Women's Commission, where I felt that I was adequate to cope with women's political as well as economic problems. But I didn't feel that I could cope with it.
Maybe you didn't
the
connection with your daily work in organizing.
Yes, that is
I
true.
Mean, which is the bulk of theirs, and not making a connection, really.
Yeah,
you
well,
should discuss the
well there were many trade unionists who did participate. There were
uh-huh.
many who were much more vocal and articulate than I was.
Uh-huh.
But they enjoyed that give and take, you see, of party controversy. And I somehow or other was more of an activist in a sense,
right.
and not so much of a politician, you see.
Mm-hmm.
I mean politician in the real sense of the word.
What did you see as the significance of it for your daily work? The change in line.
Well, I felt
that
it gave me a clearer understanding of world politics.
Mm-hmm.
I felt that I was discovering something I hadn't known before, and I was always a very eager person, eager to learn. And I felt that if the change was made, perhaps it would also be a benefit to the leadership of the various unions who were now in conflict because of the pressures now that they were feeling from the government, you see, pressures against Red leadership, which was beginning to be felt very strongly. And if you will recall, this was there were a great many defections from the party, like Quill and others, who claimed they were never members, but actually they conferred very often with party leaders.
But they also felt that the party had sold them out, too.
Well, I don't know in what way they felt that they had to toe a line that they couldn't accept.
That their rank and file workers couldn't accept.
And that their rank and file workers couldn't accept, and perhaps that they couldn't accept because they wanted to hold on to their leadership positions in the union. And this was a very important aspect of most of these career men in the trade unions. For example, in our own union, we had Jay Rubin, who was once a member, the head of all the local unions that were related to food and hotel industry in the city. He was the head, he was the brains, he was a very brilliant man, but he had for many years been a member of the Central Committee of the Communist Party. And he was pulling out very quickly because he feared that this would jeopardize his...
So it was real opportunism on this part.
It was partly, in the beginning, it was partly opportunism and partly the feeling that the decisions of the party were no longer related to their...
activities. The decisions of the party were no longer related. There are either two things to do, either to try to change the decisions of the party...
Which they may have tried to do, because I was never in on those discussions. They may have tried to do that, but on the other hand, I really think that they had to make a choice between the party and their trade union leadership. And they felt that they'd sacrificed the union and all the work they had done. At that point, they were not, they were still somewhat idealistic. Later, they became real opportunists in the sense that their career was the trade union, and they were going to fight for that, and they didn't care whom they stepped on in the process. But I think in the beginning, they were genuinely concerned about protecting the union. The personal motive was not as evident, you see.
Now, the thing is, do you think that they felt that they had built the union?
They had
the communists, is what I hadn't really helped them
build
the union.
Oh, that's not
they
true.
They didn't feel that.
That's not true. No, the communists were very supportive of all. The communists were the initiators of all this union activity. The Trade Union Unity Council in the 30s, the activities of Foster, they really were the inspiration to all these new CIO unions and AFL unions that came about. They were behind everything.
Then why didn't...
Why
did they desert the communist movement just at the time when it was dying?
They deserted it. At the later stage, when the defections actually took place, it was pure, in my opinion, it was pure opportunity.
But you see, they killed the labor movement at the same time. If they thought they were preserving the labor movement...
They didn't kill the labor movement. They preserved their unions. But they went over to the establishment position of the old reactionary AFL and CIO leaders.
So in that way, they killed the militant tradition.
They killed the militant tradition. That is correct.
I mean,
they did that. But it was very hard for them to kill that militant tradition, as is evidenced in the fact that almost up to the day that I went to jail on behalf of the Joint Anti-Fascist Refugee Committee, the members of my union, though they were generally more backward than, let's say, the fur workers or the electrical workers or other workers, supported me to the very last ditch.
Really?
They felt that I had been there as a representative of the union, and the union had to stand back of me.
And your union retained my
services until the day I went to jail, even though I had already been convicted.
Well, that was unusual, though, wasn't it? Some of the unions went out when they were down.
Yes. None of the unions had quite the same situation as this, but they had other situations in which they fired communists and which they even had a witch hunt drive.
This is what I think. Since you were such a good union organizer and so good in your role as welfare director and as educational director, therefore the union members supported you.
Well, of course, I had really what politicians call a constituency.
Right.
I had people who liked me, who felt that I was dedicated, who knew that I had done them great, had been a great help to them personally. And they were behind me, and they felt that they had to keep the promise that the union had made when I was appointed, namely that they would support me as a representative of the union to the committee. And when all of the activities occurred around the Joint Anti-Fascist Refugee Committee, and I reported to them regularly, they supported me.
Mm.
And they supported me to the very day that I...
But perhaps if you hadn't been... Perhaps, I'm just saying, that some of the people that were not supported maybe they weren't as devoted to the workers as you had been. That might be.
I think yeah. that as far as the hotel union is mm-hmm. concerned, and that is the only union
right,
I can speak
I
of, with any kind of authority, all of the organizing staff, with the possible exception of one or two new ones that had been brought in as a result of organizing drives, because the drives were going
right.
on all the time, all the organizers were very supportive of me, and of course the union newspaper gave me lots of...
How about the party? Were they supportive of you?
Oh, definitely.
Really? Because they weren't of the Rosenbergs and other people.
Oh, no, but in this case, they supported Trotsky,
right.
they supported...
How come?
Well, because... I don't know. No. I really don't know. I think that in the case of the Rosenbergs, there is real fear that they would be next, and the intimidation of the government had something to do with their attitude. I'm quite sure.
But how come they supported you when they had the same?
But you see, ours was the first attempt by government to break up the left wing front. The Joint Anti-Fascist Refugee Committee was a united front of many elements throughout the country, and it had enormous support. We had enormous funds at our disposal. We attracted the middle class, intellectual, professional class, and we had great support among the people of the United States. And ours was the first to be broken up because they saw in this united front the beginning of a large-scale left movement,
mm-hmm.
and to break this up, they recognized that the least dedicated, that is the people who were on the fringes of the left, were the people that you had to disenchant as soon as possible.
And so they thought if they could get the most.
And so they thought that if they could intimidate the weakest
section, right.
then they would. You see, they didn't touch the communists until 4 or 5 years later.
Mm-hmm.
It was only when the witch hunt was in full bloom that they proceeded against the Communist Party itself.
Right.
So, of course, we had the support of the party and the left wing, but we were not truly a party organization.
Right.
The Joint Anti-Fascist Refugee Committee had many communists in it, there's no doubt about that, and there were communists in the leadership, but there were also non-communists.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people.
It was really the end of the United, getting rid of the United Front, going into the New Jersey.
Right. It was getting separating the middle class from the left wing movement.
From the workers.
And once you separated the middle class, which had the funds and so on to support us, then you could hit at the core of the left wing movement.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't want us to have any support. You see, they wanted to strip the communists of all support and then hit them hard.
Mm-hmm.
There was a real strategy involved
mm-hmm.
here, and maybe someday it will be exposed.
Yeah, the thing is, oh,